Hello, friends. Welcome to Red Ice Radio. I'm your host, Henrik Palmgren, and I hope you're having a good day today as we continue our investigations and inquiries into many of the topics that we find to be of great interest and great importance. In these times of uncertainty, we hope that as we explore consciousness, our perception and experience, and the layers of cover-ups and propaganda that we are subjected to in the media and in politics, that we'll be able to help to bring new perspectives to your awareness, and that you'll consequently broaden your comprehension of the world and the tactics of those who seek to divide and conquer. We have much more for you on redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com. Our guest today is Suzanne Venker. She has written extensively about politics, parenting, and the influence of feminism on American society for more than a decade. Suzanne is the author of 3 books and a Kindle single called The War on Men that we are going to discuss today. Suzanne joins us for an hour, and this program is a companion, if you will, to the 3 excellent Radio 314 programs Lana recently has done on feminism with Lisa Arbacheski, Paul Elam, and Lucian Valsan, the last one I co-hosted as well. You can check these out at radio314.com or simply click the 314 links from the Red Ice Radio Archive. Suzanne talks about how over the last 4 decades, America has witnessed a profound change in marriage and gender relations. Suzanne explains how modern feminism, with its relentless talk of hapless housewives, female empowerment, and gender role reversal, has severed the bond between the sexes, pitting men and women against one another. And welcome, Suzanne. Thank you for coming on Red Ice Radio here. We're glad to have you with us. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. So you have a few interesting titles behind you. The War on Men, one that I think is just very interesting topic. We have done a couple of shows on this in the past now. And you have another title called The Flip Side of Feminism. Also, How to Choose Your Husband and 7 Myths of Working Mothers. And so I understand, Suzanne, you have a background as being a middle and high school teacher. So tell us, how did you end up writing about feminism and gender politics, if we can call it that?
Yeah, that is a good phrase for it. You know, it was sort of a side thing for me. It's something I've always been interested in, despite going into education initially. It wasn't really so much purposeful as much as just circumstances of my life leading itself to writing and leaving the public schools where I was at the time. And my first book was actually on education and my experience there. And then that got derailed. And then by the time I picked up the pen again, I was pregnant. And so my interests changed a bit. And I got into the whole, you know, work, motherhood, life, marriage, you know, all those work-life issues, all that stuff that we hear so much about. And everything just sort of went from there. And so that was about 13 years ago. And then I have 2 children, so I've been home with them between the first book and the second book, because once you have 2 children, there's no book writing going on.
Yeah.
The first one I could work around the napping and whatnot, but once there's 2, forget it. So there, I had a long hiatus there in terms of writing, or I just wrote articles, really, when I could. And then I wrote Flipside, and that came out in 2011, I guess. And then immediately following that, the How to Choose a Husband. And then the War on Men came, by the way, just a 25-page, you know, 99-cent deal you can get on Amazon. It's not a traditional book like my others.
Right.
And that came about as a result of my article that had gone viral last November on Fox News.
Yeah.
And it was interesting because it kind of preempted my book. And it put the focus more on the War on Men and less on the book, but that's okay. So I just had to sort of go with whatever's happened as it was happening. So
yeah.
Right now I do seem to be in the throes of the issues involving men, and I've gotten very involved in that even on an activist level. So
yeah, there seems to be a lot of debating going on about some of your articles online. I've been reading some of that, and I'd love to ask you about some of that. But define for us then, Suzanne, the War on Men, what that is and what that entails, what that means.
Okay. So that's obviously a provocative term, and it was meant originally when I wrote that title for that article back in November, it was just we were in the throes of hearing about the war on women all the time, and so that was what was on my mind. And so I was trying to present a completely different view of that issue, and say that issue meaning gender politics, and say, you know, the issue really isn't about a war on women at all. It's quite the opposite. women have had nothing but a leg up, if you will, and tremendous amount of attention for decades now since the rise of feminism. And there has been another, there have been many ramifications to that, and that we don't discuss them. And one of them is what has happened with gender relations and what has happened with men specifically in terms of becoming really more of the second class citizens than the women ever were. And that was a provocative argument, and it was a very short article, so I didn't get a chance to expound. So I'm glad my friend Helen Smith has done that. I don't know if you got a hold of her book, Men on Strike, which came out about 2 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really a greater extrapolation of what I was talking about in that article, which is what's happening with boys in school, which Christina Hoff Summers has written about on the war against boys. And then I focused more in that article on gender relations and the fact that there is a growing number of men who are rejecting marriage. And it has a lot to do with the gender role, I don't know what's, you know, what the best, confusion, maybe for lack of a better word,
right,
that men and women find themselves in today, that they really don't know who's supposed to do what anymore, and it's causing a tremendous amount of problems.
Yeah, indeed. It's very interesting. Now, I thought, obviously, by default then, or, you know, people might have that assumption that all women are kind of feminists by default, right?
Yes.
So aren't you supposed to be, you know, for women and their, you know, their rights and everything else, right? So explain that to us. How did that happen?
Right.
How do you flip that?
So my argument has been all along that it's so unfortunate that the assumption is that you, by nature of being a female, are a feminist thinker. And I think that the reason why that's so much a given today or an assumption is that feminists have done a great job of presenting the package of feminism and all the policies that they want and so forth as being pro-woman, so that if you are not for those policies, then you're clearly anti-woman or you're a sellout or what have you. And of course, that's ridiculous. You know, there are many, many ways to approach these very serious issues, whether we're talking about abortion, daycare, family leave policies, or sex, you know, just gender relations or gender politics in general. And that doesn't make you pro or anti-woman. It just means that you have a specific opinion. And,
right,
you know, how dare it not fall under the feminist umbrella? You know, they've had the microphone for just way too long. And so really what my passion is and my, you know, angle, if you will, is to show that other side that gets absolutely no play in the media. And then when it does get play, it gets, you know, those people get marginalized for being too this or too that, and or out of touch, or, you know, backward or whatever. And that's actually, the irony of it all is, the thing that gets me the most going is that it's actually non-feminists who really make up the majority of thinkers. And the reason why, in other words, most people are not in lockstep with feminist ideology or their policies. But the reason why you or I or Joe Schmo doesn't know that is because we mainly hear from feminists, because, of course, they dominate in the media. So we're not hearing that voice that's just regular everyday men and women. And that's my concern.
Well, yeah, I agree with you. You know, coming from Sweden, there's no debate in that country in the media. There's always a one-sided argument. And I feel that that is actually what's creating... that is what's creating the dangerous, you know, situation, if you will, where one of the sides is basically constantly being suppressed. It's not being heard. That's when you're going to cause more polarization, and that's going to, you know, lead. Well, that's going to further intensify this quote unquote war, you know, that you're talking about.
Yes, I agree.
And that's very unfortunate. Yeah,
it is very unfortunate. I mean, there's no way to get anywhere if you're completely being shut out all the time, and somebody's taking over with a certain ideology, and of course. Most people do not want to be out of step. You know, it's not comfortable. It's not comfortable to say something that isn't politically correct and then be shouted down. So they just don't. They keep their mouths shut. So I've become sort of a spokesperson, I guess, for that group.
And I guess as well, being a woman, then do you feel that it's safer than, let's say, that a man would talk about these things?
You know, I do. I do. And I think that when men, it's unfortunate, and I can't change this at all, but I do think that when men speak out, they are immediately typecast as not being allowed to have that opinion, really because they are male. I mean, you take the issue of abortion, and that, you know, you don't hear men on their soapbox about that issue. I mean, it's considered a woman's issue when in fact, of course, it's not. And child rearing and or reproductive rights, for lack of a better phrase, is a human issue. It's male-female issue, but it's solely female-driven. So when you're missing a huge part of the population, the voice of a huge part of a population, you're not really getting anywhere. You're just following in lockstep with the people who are the loudest.
Yeah,
and make the most noise.
Indeed. Now, okay, before we then, you know, talk about some of the problems, I want to ask you to, you know, kind of what entails in this war and who's behind it and everything, but let's just go back a little bit in history if we can, and I want to ask you about where you see then, you know, the feminist movement come in. You talked about how basically a lot of damage has been left in the wake of this movement and everything else, but how was this then introduced and how were things from the mm-hmm. beginning? Were things all right in the beginning, if we can, you know, begin at that point?
I think they were a little bit less innocuous, or seemed less innocuous at the time, or seemed more innocuous at the time, I should say, because we didn't have the chance to play out the ideas that feminists were putting forth yet. You know, it's been decades now. We kind of see the result with respect to the family, and specifically the family and what's happened there, as being directly related to feminist argument, which is that women are unduly burdened, they are constantly victims, they need government to come in and sort of save them, if you will, marriage is a bad deal, all of these messages that at the time, you know, were relatively new. And so if you're trying to tap into any kind of victim group, which they were basically saying, you know, women are in this bad place, so therefore let us go out and get our rights. That's not a difficult thing to do. You know, there's plenty of people out there whose lives are not working out the way they wanted. And if they think there's a group that's going to talk on their behalf, even if what they're saying isn't really going to be helpful to them, they're still going to jump on board because they're looking for any support they can get. So I don't think it's difficult to get something going like that, because there's always going to be that segment of the population. But of course it snowballed. And one thing led to another. And of course we also had regular stuff that was separate from feminism, just progress in general. So for example, if you look at technology and how that's changed people's lives, and how people have fewer children today, and how the birth control pill, which, by the way, feminists didn't create, changed everything.
Mm-hmm.
Because obviously the fewer children you have, the more of a presence women are going to have in the outside world. That's just common sense. So that's not something they can take credit for, and I'm not saying it is necessarily a credit. But that was something that was natural and going to happen anyway, feminism or not. So I think a lot of times the progress that is natural, that is separate from these groups that band together, get confused, and they will take credit for things that really they didn't have much to do with at all. So, and same with just like computers and the internet and even labor-saving devices. If you go back each decade, there was some, you know, major technological advance that liberated women, if you will, from the drudgery at home. You know, I mean, you go back to your own mothers, obviously she was going to have to spend a lot more time in the kitchen or in the home front than I would, just because of those devices alone. And so a lot of this progress, as I'm saying, was just natural. But feminists really honed in on something that was more victim-oriented and quite actually Marxist. Betty Friedan was a Marxist, and that was not something that people made the connection to at the time, because,
yep,
again, they were just honing in on what she said, that your life can be better, and it's so bad, and it's not fair, and blah, blah, blah. But in fact, it's very much, feminism is very much rooted in political ideology, and I think it's taken a lot of time and focus on what came of feminism, and then, of course, studying it, for people to really understand that it's not what it started out to be.
Yeah, this is a very interesting point, of course, where things have, you know, I've seen this for a long time, that it's been turned, so many other interest groups and everything else has been turned into basically a political strategy. But who would you argue then is kind of, you know, behind this war and the inception? Was feminism, you know, co-opted by Marxism, or was this, you know, in there from the get-go?
Yeah.
What do you think?
Oh, definitely. The 60s feminist movement with Betty Friedan and Gloria Steinem and that group were trying to piggyback off this earlier movement, which they hadn't heard much about until really the, you know, suffragette movement, which was, and then of course women got the right to vote in all 50 states in 1920. So prior to that, feminism had a presence, and then between 1920 and 1960, not so much. But in the 1960s, when they, you know, sort of began their movement, if you will, they piggybacked on the suffragette movement, suggesting that they were just picking up where they left off, and that really their agendas were the same. But in fact, that's not true at all. Suffragette movement was very much concentrated on voting rights for women, and they were also very pro-family and anti-abortion. So that right there separates them from the 1960s feminists in a huge way. So really these two groups don't have a lot in common, but it's very easy to, again, get people on board if you sound more benign than you are.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, most people agree that women should vote, so most people aren't going to have any problem with the earlier feminist movement.
Yeah.
So that's part of the problem there, is that they did co-opt it, and unless you have studied it, studied it basically, you're really not going to know this.
So if we look at the suffragettes movement, the policies in there, I guess, if we can call them policies, are things that you agree with, but it's later on along the time when things change into a more political strategy that you basically feel, oh, something's wrong here.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So let's talk about some of those policies and what that is. I mean, is it just, again, primarily that it's connected with Marxism, or is there more behind that as well?
Well, it's about undermining the family unit, basically. That's really the gist of it. And again, they don't come out and say that, because who the heck is going to, you know, jump on board if you say it that way? But ultimately, it's an ideology, it's a political ideology that is rooted in believing that America as it stands is an inherently unfair place to women, and that the family unit sets that up for her as being automatically, because she will be out of the workforce for X amount of years, because she has this body that creates babies, and that's not fair because men can stay in the workforce, as though that's somehow superior to raising babies, which I completely disagree with, that somehow using that setup, if you will, makes people feel victimized. And so ultimately what they want is a completely, you know, you've heard Obama, I'm sure, that famous phrase that he wants to fundamentally transform America.
Mm.
And that mindset, that worldview, is absolutely in keeping with feminist ideology, which is why the two are so closely related, feminists and Obama. And of course, he is one, and they pull his purse strings and he responds, and that's how that works. But so it's very much a political movement and a goal to say that the traditional family is dead, and that's a good thing because it was never working to begin with, because it was unfair, so on and so forth. So we're going to create this new system, and that involves heavy government involvement. And they love Sweden, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Oh, for sure. The Nordic model. We've talked about that many times on the program, how it's being promoted, and it's the country of favor. And yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes. They love Sweden. So. Yeah. I always say, well, go move there.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah. Well,
I'll
that's right.
America,
well,
so
I mean, what's
go
been
ahead.
Good, you know, is that we've had differences in the world, Suzanne, where there have been differences between countries. And okay, I mean, granted, everybody can't just, you know, maybe pick up and you know, move their roots elsewhere right away. But the bottom line is that what's happening right now politically is that the world is being homogenized, and the, you know, politics is being turned into the same thing. I mean, we see this with the European Union as well, of course. It's just being homogenized. Everything is being the same.
No question about it. And so, and feminism is, you know, leading the charge on that. And I don't think people don't really see it as they, you know, they still see it today, I think, as just that movement that once existed that had to do with women's rights, and but we're over that now, so let's move forward. But, and that's all well and good, except they are not moving forward. They're very much alive and well with an agenda. And so that agenda, my argument is that agenda conflicts with what most Americans want, and the research shows that. And I just think Americans don't really realize how those voices and policies undermine the life that they want for themselves, that most women want for themselves. For example, all the research shows that women, by and large, choose part-time work over anything else. They want to accommodate for the fact that they have children, and thus will be moving in and out of the workforce over the course of their life in a way that men typically will not or do not. You know, they are more linear in their career goals, and that has a lot to do with biology, which, of course, they reject because all biology is fake in their mind, and it's all socially constructed gender.
Right.
yeah. And you don't really want what you think you want. It's just that society tells you that.
That's right.
So, you know, like you can't think for yourself about that sort of thing. But anyway, so they want essentially, you know, both men and women, but their ultimate goal is 50-50 representation across the board in every social sphere. So both at home and in the workplace, in politics and business, all of that. So that you see at least half of our homes run by men and half of our government and other institutions run by women. That's what their ultimate goal is. So they'll never be happy until we get there, which of course we're light years away from that, especially since women have said, and really in no uncertain terms based on what they choose, which is to, for example, go for middle-level job instead of managers or the corner office or what have you. You have that big issue going on over here with Sheryl Sandberg's new book, Lean In, and that her message really does not resonate with most women because they don't want her life. They want a life, as I said, that accommodates for being a wife and mother, and they want a career track that allows them to be fully engaged, or at least as engaged as they can be, on the home front. So we're going in the wrong direction on that front if we're following feminist policies.
Tell us, I mean, in your book, Seven Myths of Working Mothers, you argue, I was reading about the book, and basically this idea that you can't be, you know, both the boss at the workplace and at home, there's like, it's impossible. And so therefore, that's why you've come to, you know, this conclusion, basically, that, all right, if you instead favor, you know, raising a family and taking care of the kids, you know, you need to put more energy and time into that, as opposed to being all over the place and being shattered and split in your focus and attention. But it's just basically impossible, right? You can't do it. Tell us about that more.
Well, just that's it. You just said it. It is impossible. And the biggest problem that we have, at least in America, although I'd say this across the board, is that we can't accept it. You know, we just don't want to accept that you can't have it all. We know it, but we can't accept it. And the world and the media keep telling us that we can, if only, if only, if only. And those if onlys are always about men or the government or employers and how if they would just step up to the plate, women could achieve this utopia. But the reality is you can't possibly be at the top in two different arenas like that, which both, especially since both of those arenas require your effort, your time, your energy, and all of the rest. So if you want a pie to turn out really well, better than the store-bought pie, it's going to take twice as much effort and attention than if you just picked it up off the shelf. And therefore, the result is going to taste better. It's going to look better. It's going to smell better. So it's the same thought process, whether you're talking about building a business or being successful at work or being successful as a parent. Those two things conflict naturally, not because society set it up for women to fail, but because they are naturally in conflict, because both require so much time and effort and attention. And so I'm saying you have to make your choices. You have to pick what's going to be most satisfying for you and what you think is right and best and what your gut tells you. And I think for most people, again, going back to what I said about women choosing part-time work over full-time, their gut tells them that family is really, hello, why we're here, you know, what it's all about. Obviously, it takes precedence over being successful in any other kind of way. And I think that we have seen that, and we've seen those messages from people who have failed, if you will, in the home front and been successful in the outside world, or reversed that. And you have to choose which is most important. And that gets into, you know, values and priorities and all the rest, which, of course, in America at least, are very different from the way they were 50 years ago. And you have materialism that is very much involved in that, obviously.
Yeah.
So it's a big issue with, I think, really obvious answers. But it's not politically correct to talk about it any other way than to say, yes, you can have it all. And, of course, you're entitled to and you deserve it. And if your kids are suffering, that's not your fault. Or if you're not successful at work, that's because your boss didn't let you be. I mean, it's just this lack of personal responsibility for our choices.
Yeah, yeah. So the situation, you know, in the past was, you know, one paycheck, you know, could take care of an entire family. And usually then the man was working and everything else, and the woman was staying at home. And so do you think that I mean, I've always been interested in how it went from that into basically getting both the parents into, you know, the working place. The kids ended up instead in the care of the government in the schooling system. And basically this transformation seems to have been, you know, openly kind of adopted, but nothing has been questioned along the way where people are like, wait a minute, we're losing more time here. We can't raise our own children. We have to, you know, pay more money for everything. How do you see that transformation took place? Maybe it's not as simple as I described it.
Yeah, no, it is. It is. And I think people are recognizing it, but they get shouted down the moment they say something contrary to what you're supposed to say. So it's been a slow degradation of the role that full-time mothers or just parenting in general, that kind of hands-on parenting, you know, sort of in drip-drip fashion of degrading that role and saying it's not worthy. And if you're not earning a paycheck, you're wasting your life. And that message came through loud and clear over the years in countless ways as a result of feminism. So it starts in college, you know, where the whole focus when women get there is about on this huge career and life they're going to have that doesn't involve being a wife and mother. There's no discussion of that. It's as if those things aren't, you know, doesn't exist. You're planning and mapping out your whole life based on valuing this other thing that's going to, you know, make or break you, and that without it, you're nothing. And that message has been so insidious that it's been almost impossible now for people to grab a hold of doing really any work, not even just mothering or fathering, but any work that does not produce a paycheck. You know, if it makes someone else's life better, if it's for the common good, if it's, you know, something more altruistic, it's basically a waste of your time. And that gets back into our materialistic culture and how we value things instead of people. And I think that the number one leading force for that whole turnaround in our value system was feminism. And holding up the whole career as delivering so much more than it can, you know. I think that's what's really concerning for me. I mean, a job is great, don't get me wrong, and your work is great. But it has its place. You know, it's really about perspective, and we talk a lot about prioritizing our children, but we don't, it's just talk. You know, the only way you prioritize something is by doing it. I mean, children know whether you're there or not. You're either physically there or you're not. There's no way to not be there but tell them they're your priority. It doesn't work that way.
So where do you see, Suzanne, that this is going if this agenda is, you know, continued, basically, if we see more and more people? Well, I want to talk about the statistics as you see it then in terms of, you know, what you said, that there are, you know, many women then who choose a part-time job, you know, over a full-time one, and, you know, spend as much time anyway with the family. But basically where I see this is going, and when I've found at the roots of, you know, some of these people as well who's involved in these movements have actually been a connection with eugenics. And I'm going down the deep hole of the conspiracy route here right now. But Margaret Sanger, for example, she was a proponent of eugenics. And that this, the connection of destroying the family unit has been involved in the eugenics and you know, genetics technologies as well. Because, I mean, ultimately, let's face it, if there's no more people reproducing, they're not valuing the family and everything else. This is a job that will be, you know, left in the hands of the government, basically, of perpetuate the species. Might sound weird and like a sci-fi movie, but what's your take on that?
I don't think most people think that there are people out there who would actually be in favor of undermining the family. That is so out there to the average thinker that they would dismiss something like that as being paranoia.
Yeah.
And that's not really what's happening. It's just that, and then they'll fill it in with all these other rationalizations. But the reality is there are people out there that do want to undermine the family. And that's what you're up against, even if you don't see it. So the only solution is to either say nothing, which allows it to then balloon, or to speak out, in which case you will be marginalized, and that doesn't feel good either. So I think that if you do your homework and you study what these movements are really about and who's behind them and their backgrounds, which is what I have done in my work with feminism, is to really study the backgrounds of these people and you realize that there is something very strong at play here. And once you know that, it becomes almost impossible to stay quiet, you know, but but most people don't know it. So when I speak about it, or when you speak about it, and you say something that's out of line of what they hear in the media, they would question you and me. Does that
right.
make sense?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You question you shoot the messenger rather than the message.
Yes, yeah, exactly. That's been sort of the running theme of my work.
Yeah.
And then the people who get it are the people who you can see have clearly read it, and then because you can tell by what they say or what they write on a write-up or whatever, you can tell whether they've read it. And then when they have, you get a completely different picture.
Yeah, indeed.
Of what my message is.
Exactly. So, you know, again, then in the extension to that, how do you see things will develop? Will you know, humans on the whole planet have less and less children as, you know, society change politically or what?
I honestly do go back and forth about it, but I tend to be an optimist, and I don't know whether it's because I choose to believe or I just think that it's true that it will, but I believe that we will go somewhat back the other way, because I think that pendulums kind of do that. You know, that we're at this extreme end of one side of the pendulum, that the only way to go is back. But then when I say back, they freak out and think you mean back to the 50s. And I'm saying, no, back to the middle, you know, back to some semblance of being reasonable. You know, let's take progress and marry it with what we know works. The things for example, children's needs don't change. They come into the world today the exact same way they did 100 years ago. So we know that, right?
Yeah.
How are we as a society, because we're changing in the adult world, going to accommodate that fact that is static and will never change? We're trying to bring them with us on our so-called progress on the road to all these changes, but they just want the same things they wanted before. So how are we going to accommodate them? That's an example of what I mean by marrying progress with things that we know work and that will not change. That's our challenge, and I think we're failing right now.
What would you, I want to look at some of the counter arguments to some of the things that you've been talking about here and see what some of your answers is to this. But those who argue that all of this is just social constructs, you know, the roles doesn't really exist, there aren't really any differences. You know, as you said, there's a denial of biology there and so many other things, which, you know, which I then don't understand from their perspective. But what would you say to people who argue like that?
Well, a couple things. One is, if you are in the fortunate position of being the parent of both sexes, which I am, a boy and a girl, you will see for yourself how vastly different the genders are from the day they come out of the womb. So you'll find that a lot of the people who argue against that are people who do not have children, or people who do not have maybe one of both sexes, or just haven't given that, just sort of poo-poo that whole point that you can actually witness this as parents of both sexes. For example, the fact that girls will gravitate towards dolls and boys will gravitate towards guns. That's not because I shoved a doll into my daughter's hands or a gun into my son's. And when you know that and you see how it works anyway, it becomes really obvious. But more to the point is that we have had, there's been a tremendous amount of research, especially in the area of brains lately. And Dr. Luann Brizendine has written two fabulous books. One's called The Male Brain and one's called The Female Brain. And should there ever be any question about how biology plays a role in male and female behavior, all you have to do is read those two books and several others like it that have been written, and it's clear as day that people don't make this stuff up. You know, it's there, and it's very obvious. I would also point out on that front that once you're confronted with something that is factual based as opposed to just your opinion, like for example the fact that females have a tremendous amount of oxytocin in their system and boys do not. And oxytocin is what's commonly known as the bonding hormone. And when it gets released, or it does get released, I should say, anytime a female has contact with someone, so that especially men, or males, I should say, so that when women are intimate, they are, because they're relational beings, they will bond with that person at a much faster rate than a male will. And that is because of the oxytocin that they have that men do, actually men do have, but it's a very, very small amount, and it's counteracted by their testosterone, which women don't have. So these things, when you are confronted with a feminist type thinker who says that's just, you know, the reason boys and girls are the way they are is because we socialize them, and you educate them about these things that are not opinion but fact, they basically don't have a response other than to say, that's not true, which of course isn't a response. it's just a denial. But so if the personal hands-on experience of being the parent of a boy and a girl doesn't do it when you challenge them, then I would suggest challenging them with the facts that we have now unearthed with respect to brain differences. And they generally are very stumped. I know that Gloria Steinem, when this came out a couple years ago, all this brain research, you know, she was confronted by a reporter and said, well, aren't there biological differences we can't ignore that are so obvious now? And she said, well, even if that's true, society can certainly intervene to change that behavior.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
They believe, I mean, they just, there isn't any reasoning with them because they so don't, they just will never believe in biology. They don't believe biology is destiny. And they think that's a horrible, horrible, horrible thing. That must be changed, even if it is true.
So, right. Yeah. These are limitations. And with technology and everything else,
yes,
we can overcome these, you know.
Yes, yeah. Correct. Yeah. And then ultimately, women can do anything and everything men can, and vice versa. But not only can they, and I wouldn't even argue that in many ways that's true, but that they want to. They want women to want something different than what most women do want. They want most women to want what they, and I'm referring to they meaning feminists, who are a smaller, who represent a minority group, they want most women to think and want, to think like they do and want what they do, but most women don't. So that's why they're constantly in this conflict, because they can't get most women to think.
Well, I mean, what I don't understand here again is like, all of these should just be simple individual choices, no matter how people choose to live their lives. And even if there happens to be a girl who break the gender mole or a guy who does it,
right. So
what? You know, but in this case, we have lobby groups, interest groups, we have politics, we have government coming in here and trying to, like, you know, organize and move around something which is for thousands of years have just had a natural way of unfolding, you know? So it's... it's crazy.
Absolutely. And it's important to make that distinction that, no, it's fine if you're not part of that mold. No one's saying you need to be. But it's okay if you are. It doesn't have to be taken out of you. That's my point.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so true. And I mean, we had I think it was last year, a Swedish toy maker that actually published a so-called gender-neutral children's Christmas catalog. I don't know if you saw this, but it was pretty interesting when you looked at the pictures, too, because you had... they think, all right, let's do something different then. Let's not have these stereotypical kind of things in the magazine. Okay, so let's show a boy with a kind of a child-rearing doll kind of thing and a small girl with a machine gun. let's just reverse it, and then they will be all good. You know, it's like what it shows, if anything, it shows about the confusion of the parents and the confusion that they have about all of this, and that they need to try to... You know, they don't know what to do, but usually what happens is that the boy ends up in a pink dress. That's what happens. Now they think, now we've liberated the gender stereotypical relationships here.
Oh, it's just awful. And the joke is that the kids are kind of looking up at the parents like, we're nuts, which we are, because they're fine with what they're doing.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, it's pretty interesting. So tell us a little bit more how you see that the gender roles have been confused and how this kind of plays out today. I mean, later I wanted to ask you a little bit about the media and you know, what we see about the male roles in television and everything else, but these roles have been confused. And how do you see that the method has been to do that?
So I think the ultimate message, the underlying message that women received, however they did, whether it's from their own mothers, and certainly that was the case for a lot of them, and if it wasn't from their mothers or their fathers, then it was absolutely from the culture and from even their college environment, or schooling, I should say, is that in order to be, and this is what interests me the most in terms of gender relations, is that in order to be equal or worthy. I guess I'll use the word worthy because that's really what equality is about. It's about self-worth. In order to be worthy in a way that they have been taught to believe men are naturally worthy, which is so twisted because it was never that way. But anyway, they need to prove themselves by being strong and in control and making money. And by doing, in other words, the higher up you go and the more you achieve in the outside world that requires typical male qualities, the more you've proven your worth. And the more you're going to be successful, not just, and you will be successful doing that in the outside world, but you will not be successful in your relationships. That's the part that interests me the most, that they've taken this mentality about strength and control, and they've applied it across the board, not just in the working world, but in their private lives. So I would argue that, yes, those traits, those stereotypical traits, will get you pretty far in the outside world, but they're going to screw up your relationships at home. Because the home, as a wife and mother, and I'm honing in on women here because they're the ones who got this message most of all, is not the place to assert your strength and your control. It just doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
You're not trying to rise up in the ranks in your family, or you shouldn't be. And so if that's, and women, I don't think have any tools to know how to be that strong, competent, in control person outside the home and then be a different person inside. I don't think they ever mastered that, or were even taught that you can't do that in both arenas. You have to turn that off and wear a different hat at home.
Mm.
And that's why their relationships are, you know, faltering. And that's why gender relations is faltering, because again, people aren't understanding who's supposed to do what. And so there's this real clash of where men used to be the stronger figure in terms of, you know, physical strength, and then the head of the household kind of thing, woman as supporter, or more nurturing or softer, what have you. And that's all screwed up because women are adopting the male trait, thinking that's superior, which it never was superior.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, that's a really good point as well. It's never been about that, but it seems like the adaptation of the other trait, that's the only interest here. So you're turning, you know, women into men and men into women, basically.
Precisely. Yeah. And women and men don't want another man unless they're gay.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
So you have a generation or two of women who are essentially acting like men, which goes back to the my article that I'd written on the war on men, where I said that men said are telling me that women aren't women anymore, and that's what they mean. They mean soft and nurturing and kind and supportive and all those things that feminists consider being a doormat, and they just don't understand that that's not the same thing. But they've taught women to think that way. So women have no idea what to do now with those qualities, those traits.
Well, what would
That's
you say?
A big one.
Yeah, indeed. What would you say to people done this Sunday? Just basically, you know, come on, let's get real here. Patriarchy still rules. The you know, men run the world, and the only reason that the world is in such issue and trouble is because we have too much men everywhere. What would you say to that?
Well, if men run the world, then how is it, at least in America, that women are 60% now of all college campuses and are doing better overall, both in jobs and just in jobs and education, and obviously are more than half, about 51% of the vote. So I've never seen really an oppressed group that has that kind of power. So the fact that more men are in higher positions, which is Sheryl Sandberg's argument in Lean In, does not prove an unequal society at all. That's her argument. It proves that women don't want that same life and that they've made different choices. It has never proven systemic discrimination. That's her argument. That's their argument. And mine is that those circumstances you're describing are a result of individual choices that people make that are just as valid. Indeed, I'd say even superior in some ways, to the other choice. And so that in and of itself does not prove equality or inequality whatsoever. The fact that more men, for example, are in politics or at higher positions or whatever. But the flip side of that is that if there are more women who are excelling both in colleges and in the workplace, how on earth could they be oppressed? So it depends how you define patriarchy. If you define patriarchy as just the fact that more men have higher up positions, that doesn't cut it. That's not a patriarchy. It's not proof of a patriarchy, I should say.
Yeah.
To them it is. To them it is, because that's what they value. They value money and prestige more than anything else. Way more. They don't have any, they literally think nothing of, for example, the nurturing parent who's spending years and years and years caring for children or raising a family for free, essentially. They don't value that. It's elitist, really. I don't know how else to say it. Mm. So it's a clash of values is what we're dealing with.
And that's also then why so many, I guess, socialist and communist ideologies have played so well into this as well, because at the same time, then what's to blame or the fault for all of this is the system of capitalism, basically. Right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Wow.
So all you have to do is get a group, you know, get enough people on board with that. Yeah, 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 that's right. You know, and all of a sudden it balloons and you have a movement.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. It's very easy. Do you think that we're making a big mistake when we focus so much attention or too much on the gender as the distinguishing point between us? And we basically we're creating two different camps now. And again, I mean, I've seen this as the Hegelian dialectic in other circumstances, in politics, etc., where you basically divide the camp into two, you know, in two groups, and then you have them basically fighting with each other while you progress politically on the different end, if you see what I'm getting at. While we're spending time fighting with each other, you know, politically we're losing the game here, you know?
I think it's okay to talk about the differences between the genders as long as, in addition to that, we're focused on what the same goal is. So if you have the same goal and the same values, then those differences work together to achieve that goal. So what we have now is just a focus on actually quite the opposite of the differences, which is that we are, you know, ultimately the same, that men and women, equality represents sameness, that one can be interchanged with the other with no ramifications whatsoever, and that's a fair world or what have you. Well, that's not focusing on our differences enough. So I would say there needs to be a discussion of what those real gender differences are, and not just a discussion, but an acceptance that they're real, that they exist, and that that's okay. And then along with that, now how are you going to work with those differences to achieve this common goal that all men and women have, which is to love and be loved, which is to have a family for most people, and just, you know, be attached and have a sense of place. You know, I think most people do want the same things, and I don't think we talk enough about that piece of it. But again, dividing, like you said, men and women into separate camps as though their interests are not the same when they are.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, it's very clever in that way. I mean, some people have called that what you talked about there about basically that it's an expression of sameness, basically, and I've heard it from the context of Swedish people talking about this is a form of like hyper individualism, while I would say, at the other hand, it's more like a society of ants, where basically, you know, where everyone is a drone instead. There isn't any of these differences, and there isn't an individuality in there at all, but it could be mistaken for being that, you know.
Well, and the best example is if you're a woman who doesn't jump on the feminist bandwagon, then that's an individual stance that you should honor, but you don't, because you're not joining part of you're not joining
right.
the bandwagon.
Yeah, exactly. So you have to do what the majority does, but, you know, so if you stand outside of that, which is what allegedly this group is supposed to represent, right, the minorities and, you know, individual rights and everything else, but it does, you know, the smallest individual or the smallest minority is the individual, right? So,
yeah.
Anyway, let's talk a little bit about how you see men being portrayed in the media then specifically. You know, we have a certain stereotype coming out of the sitcoms and everything else, and, you know, this is just, this has been going for many, many years now, but is this actually, does this have an effect on men and women, do you think?
Oh, it absolutely. I can't think of anything I feel more strongly about, that the messages from the media are insidious and dramatic, and that they actually have the ability to change people's lives. And by that I mean the way, and I talk about this in the very opening chapter of my book, How to Choose a Husband and Make Peace with Marriage, which is all about, I call it the examined life, live an examined life. And I suggest that people think for a moment, or pretend, that they live in an era, say the 1930s or 40s, before television was even really there as a presence in your life. And you think about the types of visuals and that you have around you without that piece there, and that the kind of people you'd be talking to, you know, back up, not kind, who you're getting, who you're having most of your conversations with and who you're hearing from the most. It's much more family and community oriented than these people from a box in your living room. And you take a whole lifetime of living a certain way like that with your family and your community and with your own thoughts, you know, and just in that smaller world, if you will, and how your decisions and your thought processes are affected if you just have the space to think for yourself and within the limits of just your family and your friends and the community. Then you bring in the whole world into your television, right?
Yeah.
And all these messages that you're really besieged with on a daily basis that unbeknownst to you, just even when you're walking through the living room, you know, and it's a drip, drip process that changes the way you think about something, even though you haven't done your homework to determine whether or not the message you just got was in fact accurate or smart,
right,
or whatever. And so you're constantly getting it thrown into your face, and it's changing the way you think about things, which is ultimately changing the way you make what the choices are that you make. So if you take, again, this drip-drip mentality of men are idiots, which is what's been going on for a very long time, you get to the point where you become immune to it, and then you just laugh at it, and you think it's kind of funny. It's not funny. I mean, just imagine if it were reversed.
Yeah, exactly.
And it was the women who were being talked about or made fun of in those kind of ways. And it's not just the theme of a sitcom, but it's in a commercial where the man is clearly the subordinate, and the woman knows everything. She's, you know, she's going to tell him how it's going to be, and he's just a yes, 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 yes man or whatever. That's a serious message about role reversal that wouldn't have existed 50 years ago. So in the same way, those same people who argue that the messages from the Leave It to Beaver era were bad, what's the difference between reversing that? Why isn't that just as bad?
Yeah, exactly. Do you think that they feel that, all right, we have to just kind of get even for this to balance out, or what's the mentality?
No, I said this the other day to somebody, you know, I don't think it's at all about media, people who are part of the media sitting around to say, now how are we going to like change this to make it so that we're going to get them back? It's not like that. It's far
right.
more insidious. It's far more of a gradual process where you begin to think this is right and normal and good because you're not thinking, because you're going back to what we were saying before, individually, you're not thinking independently of the status quo.
Yeah.
You're not even allowed to think that way. So you're not stopping to think, wait a minute, is this okay or not okay? So you just go with it and you laugh, but it's not funny. And what's happening with men is that they are responding by bowing out. And when you hear the phrase, where have all the good men gone, what that really means is, wow, we browbeat the American male to the point where he no longer wants to be a good guy and get married and take care of his family and do all the things, you know, that women want him to do. But that's because we basically made fun of them for so long that they are, and basically not only made fun of them, but said, we don't need you because we're strong and can have babies on our own and can make our own money and see ya. Well, obviously they're going to react to that, and they have, and they are. And I think we're just in the throes of that now. And so it's going to take a really big wake-up call to recognize that we really created this situation. It's not that men have just all of a sudden, as a whole, become slovenly or sloused or whatever, but that we did something to create this environment where they no longer felt welcome. And it's a very scary place to be.
And then there's a feedback maybe too. That's when, you know, young teenage boys and you know, growing men and everything else kind of see this, it becomes a feedback loop. And in a certain way, they understand, you know, subconsciously that, you know, the role that they, you know, that was once there is not there anymore. I mean, the drive,
yes,
maybe is not there. They're home playing video games,
exactly,
instead of, you know, trying to get somewhere, if you know,
exactly,
what I mean.
Exactly. And they, of course, that you have the fatherlessness as a result. So the,
yeah,
fatherless homes,
yeah,
and they're being raised with a completely different set of messages than 50 years ago. So, you know, we've created it. And so it didn't just happen. It's not like osmosis, where all of a sudden men used to be great and now they're not, and what, we just, you know, women just gave birth to a bunch of bad guys or what? I don't understand. I mean, we did it, you know. And so it just, it takes really studying it and paying attention to be able to face it.
And in entertainment, then you have a, you know, as they see it, as you say, they're also very conformist. They do very much the same thing. They follow each other. But at the same time, they need to push the boundaries because, right, we need something new all the time. It needs to be new and exciting. So just let's do more of the same and do it more extreme, right? So that you can see really how this has been completely just gone downhill the last, you know, 10, 15 years.
Absolutely. No question about it. And that's why it's really scary when something happens so slowly that you can't see it as it's happening. And that's basically where we are. And so when you, again, when you, all you ever, at least here in America, all we're hearing about left and right is where have all the good men gone? And these women are lamenting the horrible state of American men. And I'm saying, you know, look in the mirror and see what you might have done to cause that. And that's, of course, makes me a bad woman because I'm a sellout and I'm supposed to stand with the women and against the men. And I don't do that. So I get a lot of flack. But
Yeah. Well, it's unfortunate. I mean, because you're speaking your truth the way you see it, and you know, the work that you've done, and you hold your own opinions, and you know, no one should be, you know, gone after for that. But I mean, I've seen some of the articles online and how, you know, people go after you because you dare to speak in the way you do. So, well, but it's great that you do it, and I commend you for it, and you should keep doing it and speaking your truth.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Very well. Well, this has been very interesting, Susanne. I think we should round things up here for this time, but let's talk a little bit about your website. We want to give our audience a chance, obviously, to go over to your website, to take a look at some of your titles and where they go to pick up copies of your books.
Yeah, everything is actually right there in one spot. So it's just my name, Susanne Venker, SusanneVenker.com.
Very good. SusanneVenker.com. We're going to have that linked up and check out some of the titles, The War on Men, How to Choose a Husband, The Flip Side of Feminism, and also Seven Myths of Working Mothers. Thank you so much for your time, Susanne. Really appreciate it. Thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
On Red Ice Radio, we explore an incredible amount of topics. We cast a wide net and go where many others do not tread in order to get answers to the deeper questions and find out what new questions to ask. We bring you radio three times per week. We spare you from commercial interruptions. And when you want to hear the continuation of most of our radio programs and get full access to our past archives, you can acquire a membership at redicemembers.com. Show some love, show some support, and keep our endeavor going. Upcoming on Red Ice Radio, we have William F. Engdahl, Joseph Atwill, and Ryan Gilmore. We have a round table on the past and our future. And later we have Charles Eisenstein, Neil Sanders, Anthony Peake, Neil Kramer, Chaired Andringa, Joseph Farrell, and Scott DeHart, and many, many more interesting guests coming on the program. Thank you so much for listening, for considering, and I hope that we'll talk more soon. Take care.